I have to say that was the best welcome for that I've received as a State House member. Because when my constituents, when I walk into a room with my constituents, they don't clap. They tell me about the potholes in front of their house. So I greatly appreciated that. And anyway, so see, in South Carolina, we have terrible winters where the snow covers the ground and they have to throw salt and it just tears it up. You guys wouldn't understand. So anyway, it's a blizzard every year. Anyway, so, but I wanted to talk. I'm going to talk really quickly if I'm going to try to. I'm an hour off, so hopefully that doesn't throw me off too much. But I don't have a lot of time, so I wanted to just talk on something really light, quick, that we could get through easy. So I decided to talk on the purpose of our existence. So I'm glad some of you got that. So, but I am. I'm going to talk about the purpose of our existence. Why do we exist? And does anyone know the answer? Can anyone just yell it out? Why do we exist? You already taught them this, haven't you? That was like very quickly. Everyone together. Yes, we exist. Very easy answer. Why did God create us? Why do we exist on this earth? To glorify God. Isaiah 43:7, for I have created him for my glory. I have formed him, yea, I have made him. And verse 21, this people have I formed for myself. They shall show forth my praise. So God created you and me. He created us, his people, to glorify himself, to show forth his praise. Revelation 4:11, thou art worthy, O Lord, to receive glory and honor and power, for thou hast created all things, and for thy pleasure they are and were created. So you were created for God's pleasure. And isn't that an amazing mystery, that we were created to glorify God, that we were created for his pleasure? And some of you may not feel like you are that pleasurable creations, like I said before, because some of you know we know our sin, and God knows us so well. He knows us more than anyone on earth knows us, and it's an amazing mystery that God finds pleasure in us. But when I say that we were created for worship, that's a nice thought. Okay, we have the answer. But then why do we worship? Well, we're created for it, but even more than that, God commands us to worship. It's not just that, oh, that's a nice answer, we're created, we're going to glorify God with our lives. Well, then he says, well, what's the first commandment that was given to the Israelites? Anybody know that one? Yeah, exactly. I am the Lord thy God, thou shalt have no other gods before me. So worship the Lord, no other gods before me. Why did God have to tell people that? This is a simple answer, right? Because why? Because we as people are worshipful beings. We worship things. We dedicate our time towards things. We love things. We obsess over things. We give ourselves to things. We give ourselves to ourselves, right? What is the main thing that most of us today worship? Us. Now, way in the Old Testament, or not before the Old, I guess not before the Old Testament, but in the Old Testament, ancient Egypt, and we're going to sing a song in a little bit that I'm kind of leading into. It's called God of Wonders, and it's from the Patch the Pirate Adventure Time Twisters. Has anyone heard that ever? Okay, so a few of you. So if your kid's in the room and you just raise your hand, Tara Solomon was actually Cleocatra in the adventure. So the crew gets thrown back in time and they see or they hear about and see some of the plagues that God's bringing on Egypt. And in that adventure, the people are worshiping animals because they did. The ancient Egyptians worshiped animals as gods. They worshiped cats, which I just do not understand. I mean, if you really think about it, if you're going to pick any animal and you pick a cat, anyway, but it doesn't make any sense. But it's easy for us in our 21st century, right, to sit back and look at that and be like, those people weren't very smart, right? You know, they built the pyramids. We still can't really explain how that happened, but they clearly weren't very smart, right? No, people have, somebody said, right, you just really don't like cats. People have always looked around them and realized there's something greater than us. There's something amazing out there that deserves worship. And throughout the ages, they sought after, what is this? They prayed to their ancestors, or they prayed to the sun, or they prayed, in ancient Egypt, they prayed to the things that were sustaining their lives, like the river, or the different animals that were important to their ecosystem. But today, we're in the set. I really wanted to lead in the song earlier, and now we're not singing it tonight. So only one, if you were here this morning. What I like to talk about before that song is that the purpose of that song, which is from a different adventure, is it's instructing kids in a biblical worldview. Because today, we're in postmodernism, or anyway, I'm not going to go into it. They're actually changing it now to a new name. But the point of secularism, postmodernism, is that there either is no God or we're agnostic towards God. And it really, the tolerance is the high virtue. You believe whatever you believe. You create your own truth, right? And you can believe what you want, but don't project it or push it on anybody else. Don't evangelize, right? That's really like what they... That's what they're preaching. There's no absolutes. There's no, if there is right or wrong, you determine it. And that puts you in the place of God, right? Because God ultimately says what is right and wrong. And where do we find what God says is right or wrong? Yeah, of course, the Bible. So so the reason that people in ancient Egypt worshiped those cats and the reason people prayed to their ancestors for years, and the reason today we live for ourselves and for our pleasure or whatever, you know, the thing is because we're worshipful beings and we were created that way. We were created to worship God. And in Psalms, I'm trying to fly through, so I'm going to jump all around, so just hang on with me. Psalms 95, 6 through 7, oh, come, let us worship and bow down. Let us kneel before the Lord, our Maker, for he is God. New Testament extends this to everything we do. 1 Corinthians 10, 31, whether therefore you eat or drink or whatsoever you do. Some of you have been to the wilds, haven't you? Right? All right. They always do that if you didn't know whenever they eat. Anyway. So now we've talked about God commands us to worship. We're supposed to do it all the time. So what is worship? So I went to my good friend Webster, and he gave me a really good definition. So worship is ardent adoration, love, or reverential honor paid to God. Another definition, the formal or ceremonious rendering of honor and homage to God. Worship has several elements to it. It involves giving of something, pretty much always. Now, this is what do you think of when I say giving with worship? You did it earlier. Yeah, you can't answer. You gotta be quiet. Right. You've heard this before. Anyway, what is giving? The offering, right? And that's a fascinating concept because it's easy to get in, or maybe not for you, but for me, it's easy to get in my mindset that, oh, I'm giving because I get something out of church, so therefore I'm supposed to give something. And there's a principle, right? You're not, but the reality is giving your tithes and offerings is an act of worship. I'm giving something to the Lord because he commands it. He owns everything, but I'm giving something for his service. And in the Old Testament, it was the same way. I don't know if I have time to do that, but let me keep going. it's ascribing worth or value to something. Worship is. It ascribes worth or value. I'm getting in the weeds here, but you've heard of lip service. Now, we think of lip service in a bad way, but really lip service is declaring something, and really worship involves that. It's declaring something, stating something. Worship involves humility, and that is a huge key part and that I can't stress enough. The Greek word that's primarily used for worship in the New Testament, it literally means to kiss toward, to kiss the hand of, or to fall on your face in reverence. Now think of the first part of what I just read. To kiss toward, or to kiss the hand of. What in the world does that mean? You don't know what that picture is from? Think about, you know, ancient times or even, you know, medieval times. You had a king, right, that would sit on the throne in his majesty and glory of all of his weight and power, and he was the law, right? And he held your future in your hands, and you as the lowly subject would come before him. And what would you do? What would they do often? Sometimes they would get on their hands and knees and crawl up to the king, or they would come humbly, and he would hold his hand out, if it pleased him, and they would kiss the ring or the hand. What does that picture tell you? What do you get from that picture about those two people? One is in a state of what? Grandeur, awesomeness, power, mighty, and the other, servile, humble, humbled before this great, awesome power. And that is exactly how when we are worshiping God, that's what we're doing. We are humbling ourselves. It's the exact opposite of secularism. And really, I mean, it's the exact opposite. But one is, I am great, and I am worthy, and we are good. But the other is, I am broken and needy, and you are great. And I am going to humble myself to your will for my life and to your truth. And I'm going to accept the precepts you have given me as truth and not question them and not create my own truth. Anyway, there is an element even of self-humiliating in worship, similar to that. Some people say it's similar to that in service. When you serve others, think about Jesus washing the disciples' feet. It is lowly and servile, really. And it's not something that is natural, right? Like, because as people, what do we, when you guys clapped for me, it made me feel good, right? It's like, yeah, I'm a state house rep, right? That's what our flesh likes. We like recognition. We like praise. We like being told that we write nice songs. And by the way, I sing terrible. That's why they only let me sing one song out of all of those. Did you notice that? I noticed that. Anyway, I saw that. Anyway, but we like being, but think about that. What I just said, worship is being recognized for your, like, right. So we, in an odd way, we like being worshiped, or at least we like being given praise and glorified, right? That's what our flesh is. But we are called to worship someone else, not ourselves, and to recognize our true state. And I know I'm beating a dead horse, so I'm going to move on. So what does worship look like? I'm already out of time. This always happens. All right, Old Testament, doesn't it? Old Testament, Exodus 30. I'm not going to be able to read it, but basically, I took a class in law school called Jewish it was religious legal systems, but it was primarily focused on Jewish law. And the point of it was to learn how basically all law today that we do, the systems of law, originated from Jewish law. Even bizarre things like environmental law are from the Old Testament. I mean, just all sorts of, anyway. But in this, we read this in the book, the textbook we were reading, it had this picture in Exodus 30. It was talking about these people. You have these priests that are set apart, and they go through this whole system in order to be the set apart people and be like cleansed, ceremonially cleansed. And in Exodus 30, they're offering a fragrance that's incense that they create, and it's costly items. And it's this, and it's a specific thing, what's that word, like a mixture? Yeah, a recipe, there you go. It's a specific recipe. And in Exodus 30, it says it's reserved for God. The people cannot use it for their own pleasure. It's not to be used. And if you use it, you'll be condemned. So it's only for God. And it's costly. And they burn it. And it's gone. So giving something, right? And it's done by people ceremonially cleansed. It's done in a specific place. God tells you who gets to do it, how they're supposed to be, cleansed, where it's done, what it's done, like the recipe for it, and then gives extra, like, it's so very specified to the people and how he expects to be worshiped. And in the book, it talks about, from a Jewish perspective, they burn the incense and it fills, the wherever it's being done. And then it wafts, and the phrase they use, I want to make sure I read it because I don't want to get this priest, this ceremonially cleansed priest, offers this sweet-smelling, costly fragrance from his people, his chosen people, and it wafts to the nostrils of God. That from there, that's how they viewed it. That it's this thing it's from his people. It's something costly, and it's given to him. And they follow the precepts that he's given exactly, and that is worshiping him. And so we could stay there forever, but I got to move on. Psalms 100. This is often called a blueprint for worship. Make a joyful noise. If you want to read this one, you can. Psalms 100. I'm going to read the whole psalm. Make a joyful noise unto the Lord, all ye lands. Serve the Lord with gladness. Come before his presence with singing. Have you ever thought, why do we sing in a worship service? Is that really odd? Did somebody one day just say, I really like music? Because don't you guys like music? I do. And that's a nice idea. Maybe we'll stick that in a worship service. No, people, like throughout, you know, church history, that people have been using music to worship God. And here in Psalms 100, come before his presence with singing. Know ye that the Lord, he is God. It is he that hath made us and not we ourselves. We are his people, the sheep of his pasture. Enter into his gates with thanksgiving and his courts with praise. Be thankful unto him and bless his name. For the Lord is good, his mercy is everlasting, and his truth endureth to all generations. I want to go back and point one thing out. Know ye that the Lord, he is God, and it is he that hath made us, and not we ourselves. We are his people, the sheep of his pasture. Isn't that an odd thing to state during worship? Yeah. When you really think about it, why are we saying, we know you are God, know ye that the Lord, he is God, it is he that hath made us and not we ourselves? Why do we have to be reminded that we didn't make us? Anybody know? Because, yeah, it's a recognition of his power. No, remember, by the way, guys, remember, you didn't make yourself. You are the sheep of his pasture. You follow. You stray, right? That's our place. That is he that has made us. And then what else does it do? It lists things about God. It's ascribing the worth and value and recognition of who he is. Enter his courts with thanksgiving, or enter his gates with thanksgiving, his courts with praise. Be thankful to him and bless his name. That lip service ascribing, for the Lord is good. His mercy is everlasting. His truth endureth to all generations. Now we're talking about who he is, recognizing who he is. That is worship. And those are all the elements we talked about. It's humbling ourselves, recognizing who we are, recognizing who he is. As God grows bigger in our view, we grow, really, because we realize how great and pure and holy and all the other attributes and how we are not. And that goes back to the dependence upon him. Lord, I need you. And the recognizing my sin is ever before me. And I worship you. I gotta go. I know, it's 7:02. I know some of you are looking at that. All right, two kinds of worship, acceptable and unacceptable. It's a fact. Cain and Abel, the golden calf. God has a specific way that we worship him, and worship that we try to offer can be acceptable and unacceptable. And I'm not going to get too much in the weeds there, but that's a fact. A lot of times today, going back to postmodern influence, we just worship however we want. Whatever you feel like, and don't have people put structures and tell you what you is and isn't acceptable. Anyway, but I'm not going to get into that. I'm going to let your pastor do that. Worship was always reserved, or where and how do we worship? Worship was always reserved for a specific place in the Old Testament, a holy set apart place like the tabernacle or the temple, and John 4:20-24. Our fathers, if you want to read John, sorry, I go really fast. I talk too fast, don't I? I know. She's like, no. John 4:20-24, if you want to follow along. Our fathers worshipped in this mountain, and ye say, this is a woman talking to Jesus. Our fathers worshipped in this mountain, and ye say that in Jerusalem is a place where men ought to worship. Jesus saith unto her, Woman, believe me, the hour cometh when ye shall neither in this mountain nor yet at Jerusalem worship the Father. Ye worship, ye know not what. So he's talking to a woman who they were trying to do their own thing. They weren't worshiping Jerusalem. They wanted to worship in their own local place, and it was not how God had ordained it to the Jews. And he's saying, you guys don't know what you're worshiping. You're not worshiping correctly. We know what we worship, for salvation is of the Jews, but the hour cometh and now is, when the true worshipers shall worship the Father in spirit and in truth. For the Father seeketh such to worship him. God is a spirit, and they that worship him must worship him in spirit and in truth. So, the hour cometh and now is when true worshipers shall worship the Father in spirit and truth. So where do we worship today? The church. No! Trick question. We do. We come in corporately worship, but where do we worship? In spirit and truth, everywhere. We do it in us, right? We're our bodies are the temple, and today we worship in our bodies, in our hearts. We make offerings of praise to God in humility, paying homage and honor to God. Worship is to be presented to God through his spirit, made acceptable by Jesus Christ. Our bodies are the temple of the Holy Ghost. We no longer worship in temples, but in our hearts. Romans 12:1-2, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable unto God, which is your reasonable service. 1 Peter 2:5, ye also, this is good. Pay attention if you're not. Ye also, as lively stones, are built up a spiritual house, an holy priesthood, to offer up spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God by Jesus Christ. I know that wording's difficult, but you like don't miss that. Ye also, as lively stones, are built up a spiritual house, a holy priesthood. So you're a holy priesthood to offer up spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God by Jesus Christ. Okay, so I'm already over, I know, but I wonder if what I can skip. music is one of the primary modes of worship to God. Historically, the people of God have always worshiped with music. Colossians 3:16, let the words of Christ dwell in you richly in all wisdom, teaching and admonishing one another in singing with grace in your hearts to the Lord. Ephesians 5:19, speaking to yourselves in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing and making melody in your hearts to the Lord. I don't have time to do all that. I know. Old Testament, it's temple. This is so interesting, though. I'm just going to do it really quick. In the Old Testament, they had choirs. They have orchestras, right? You've read it in the Psalms and stringed instruments, and it's exciting and jubilant. It's where the presence of God is. Then the captivity happens. The people are scattered. And, I think it's in Psalms 137, they talk about they hung up their harps. And in Jewish tradition, they go into a period of mourning and the music totally changes. And in fact, as time progresses, the Pharisees take that more mournful sound that they thought was more correct for captivity, and they start, they ban instruments. The Pharisees partly did that because they felt like that was work on the Sabbath. And every instrumentalist said, no, just kidding. But it is, anyway. They didn't even do instruments on the Sabbath. And worship was more austere or even viewed as mournful. Then enter the early church. And Philo, a Jewish historian, described an early Christian church service in this way. He talks about them having all-night vigils and great festivals. They would they would discuss spiritual discipline, like, to each other. Hours are spent. The hymns are recited. One main singer will sing a regular rhythm, and the others listen silently and join on a refrain. Do you guys still sing hymns and refrains? And, I mean, that's thousands of years ago, too. Right. Anyway, give or take. But still, that's amazing that hundreds of years ago, that people are doing worship, they're discussing spiritual discipline and they're like sin struggles and they're praying and historians are talking about they read scripture publicly and now they're meeting at night because they're under persecution. But it's amazing that they're doing, the early church is doing basically exactly what you do today. There's an absolute rhyme or reason to everything you do here in your church service. Early church music was most likely similar to the chanting that Jews did in the synagogue because most of them were Jewish and had come out of the Jewish faith. But then enter all these new Greek converts and they all came in with their own, different cultures and stuff. And the sound of the early church was different, and the Jews did not like it. They thought it was jubilant. But think about what they were singing. Psalms 43, and he hath put a new song in my mouth, even praise unto our God. Many shall see it and fear and shall trust in the Lord. What the early church and what we today sing is what? What do our songs do? Well, what should our songs be filled with? Just, obviously. It's truth, spirit and truth. They were used for worship. And so our songs should be filled with truth, which is found where? Word of God, scripture. So we're singing the truths about God, who he is, recognition of who he is, our place, in relation to him. And it should, in spirit, stir our hearts to worship him. And worship him by using those truths, expressing those truths back to him. And you think about the song, Spurgeon, in talking about Psalms 43, that new song that we have as believers, we have the New Testament new song. We know the full extent of the New Testament gospel, the Christ story, the death and resurrection, and then get all of the description and explanation and furtherance of exactly what's going on with all of that. Today, Spurgeon said it best. I'm just going to quote him. He's talking about the new song. He said, it's justice magnified and grace victorious, hell subdued and heaven glorified. death destroyed and immortality established, sin overthrown and righteousness resplendent. What a theme for a new hymn, a new song. And you can't say it better than that, because that's our hymn, and it's all the truths about God, who he is, what he's done. It's about Christ. And as we sing these truths, we are offering our worship to God. And we recognize who he is, and we humble ourselves. In a worship service, our music should be creating the desire to honor and praise and glorify God. It should stimulate us to worship. It's the mode through which we can worship. It's done in spirit and in truth. Our worship should be indwelled with truth. It should stir our hearts. It should send our spirits soaring to God in the recognition of who he is and what he's done. It's rooted in truths about God, who he is, what he's done, his greatness, his uniqueness, his deservedness for his worship, his love for us, his sacrifice. And all of these truths stir our hearts and kindle our passions toward him to put ourselves and our own desires and our own pleasures in subject and low, and we exalt him and his will for our life, his truth, and recognize who he is. It causes us to fall prostrate, and it draws praise from our lips. That's why we were created, to worship God, to live every day to praise and glorify and honor him and not us, not ourselves. And the song that I want the group to come and we're going to sing, the last song is God of Wonders. And this song, like I said, it's ancient Egypt, and the crew, they see this mighty power of God, and you know, displayed in ancient Egypt. And I had expected that when we were going to write an adventure about the plagues, you know, in ancient Egypt, I had expected to spend all of my time in Exodus, right? Because that makes sense. That's where the story is. So I looked up all these. I started looking up all the different references for Egypt and the children of Israel. So guess where I spent a ton of time? And Pastor, you can't answer. Do you know? I just heard somebody say it. Psalms. Over and over again. Remember what the Lord, remember the hand of power, remember leading you through the wilderness, remember the mighty acts you saw on Egypt, remember, over and over again, because the Psalms were the worship texts for the children of Israel. And what were the children of Israel captivated by over the expanse of their history through the Old Testament? They were captivated by God's absolute display of power over the mightiest, greatest kingdom in the world at that point in time, even though they were worshiping cats. They were the most powerful, you know, intelligent, great kingdom, you know, there was. And God comes, and his people are servants. They're slaves, just like we are slaves to sin. And he displays his absolute power, and he rains hail down, you know, from heaven, fiery hail, and he kills the crops, and he turns the Nile River, which they worshiped, to blood. And the sun god, the highest god in ancient Egypt, he blots it out, and it's darkness for the end. And it's an absolute display of his power. We serve the God of wonders. And that God is absolutely worthy of our worship and our praise.